your attention for a couple of minutes. Every year we do an Washington Insiders panel to talk about what's happening, and I do it with a bunch of my friends. We do it casually, just as if we're at the Monocle restaurant, which is a hangout for lobbyists in D.C. talking, and we're going to try to do that again. At lunch the last few years, we've had the likes of Mary Matlin and Jim Carville. We had a couple of others last year, but I thought for this year's event, combining those two political things might be the best, and we've got the people that know this industry and lobby this industry every day here. I think this will be an entertaining session. Come on up, guys. So keep eating. We'll go for a little while and hopefully wrap up by 2. And if there is time, we will open it up for questions. There will be some microphones. But I don't know if there will be time or not. But pleased to have with us this group, Doggett, who is the Vice President of Public Policy for the National Corn Growers Association. He handles all of the legislative and regulatory issues for the corn growers. John was raised on a farm in Montana.
Ranch.
A ranch in Montana. But he's got 20 years of ag policy experience. He worked for a member of Congress from Montana, Ron Marlinay. He worked with the National Cattlemen's Association, and he worked with the American Farm Bureau. But as those of you that were at the RFA's pack auction last night, you know that John's real passion is kayaking.
What's the deal about Speedos?
There's not enough people in the room that were there last night that would understand the whole Speedo thing, and we're not going there. To John's left is Aaron Weitzel. He is a senior manager for government affairs with DuPont, which obviously has a lot of interest in agriculture and chemicals, and it is Aaron's responsibility to look over the ag and biofuels portfolio. He's well equipped to do so because prior to joining DuPont, Aaron was a legislative advisor to Senator Richard Lugar from Indiana, who many of you know and who is certainly one of the most passionate advocates for biofuels in the United States Senate when he was there. And Aaron has a law degree from my alma mater, the Catholic University of America. So this is Aaron's first time, and I've promised him that I will be gentle. To Aaron's left is Bob Greco. No hissing, no throwing. I appreciate the fact that Bob came. However, I make no promises to be gentle. Bob is the group director for downstream and industry operations with the American Petroleum Institute, API. He has a 23 career with API. He has overseen their exploration and production interest. He has been a policy analyst. He has worked on climate change. In the early 90s, he was in charge of API's Clean Air Act implementation. Before joining API, he actually worked for the Environmental Protection Agency. So he is well steeped in all of these issues. And I just want to say, Bob, thank you for coming. It's not an easy thing coming to the line. So you've shown professional fortitude.
Happy to be here.
Thank you. To Bob's left is somebody who is familiar to many of you. He's been here many times in the past, and he always does a great job. He represents his industry with great professionalism. Shane Carr is the Vice President for Federal Government Affairs with the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. The Automobile Alliance represents 12 car manufacturers, 4 GM, Chrysler, BMW, Toyota, probably a few more that you would recognize. Prior to joining the Auto Alliance, he was the Assistant Secretary for Government Affairs at the Department of Transportation. He's also worked from time to time with American Airlines, and he first came to Washington, I believe, working for a good friend of ours, the former Representative Doug Bierider from Nebraska. So he understands farmers, certainly understands a lot of the issues that we face. And Shane, thank you for being here again. To Shane's left is another newcomer to this panel.
First time, too.
Another newcomer who's pleading for mercy and who I also will likely not give him any. But Chris Kaiser. Chris is the president and CEO of the Outdoor Power Equipment Institute, OPEI. OPEI represents about 100 small engine manufacturers and outdoor power equipment. All of you folks that are weekend warriors working on the honey list probably are using equipment that Chris Kaiser's organization represents. Prior to being with OPEI, Chris worked for the Auto Alliance as well, working for state government issues. He was with the American Forest and Paper Association, and he also has a bit of a tie to our neck of the woods because he worked on Capitol Hill for one of the great members of the United States Congress, Lee Hamilton from Indiana, who was a real statesman and a credit to the institution, and it is lesser for his being gone. So, Chris, thank you for being here. All right. We all know how dysfunctional Washington, D.C. is. These folks have to... Are you already trying to leave?
No. I'm getting comfortable.
Okay.
Where's the seatbelt?
These folks have to work in that dysfunction each and every day. Some of these people actually try to foment dysfunction, although I'm not going to name any names. But John Doggett.
Yes, sir.
You actually worked through the dysfunction and recently saw a huge legislative success with the passage of a farm bill. I give you great credit for that.
I take all of it, too.
Yeah. I might ask how you were able to get it done, but tell us briefly about the farm bill. What do you like? What do you dislike? And
well, I think, first of all, is don't like the fact that it took so long to get it done. But I think it points out that there is a need for farm legislation to be in place. We need to have some sense of what the rules are going to be, what the program's going to be, how it's going to move forward. So, you know, that was the problem. Is I think it was a recognition of kind of where we are in the American public, where there's fewer and fewer farmers. Took a long time to get it done. The thing we like about it is that we are moving from a subsidy-oriented program to a program that is more to address the risk management areas of farming and how do you better manage that risk, whether it be from markets or from weather. And so we're very happy to see some of the places, some of the things that were put into place in this farm bill that we think are going to be pretty good for growers on down the road.
Aaron, you obviously with DuPont followed the farm bill as well. Is there, were the things in particular that DuPont was focused on in the farm bill that you were glad happened, disappointed didn't happen?
No, that's we've been following as long as John's mentioned. This has been a long, arduous process. DuPont is a broad and wide company with lots of different interests. One of those is agriculture. So John's growers are our customers, so we very much like the fact that they're now certainly moving forward, both for them, their banker, you know, the whole value chain that looks to farm policy. I think one particular area we're encouraged by is the energy title, that Congress affirmed that renewable energy is still very important, and they affirmed it with overwhelming votes.
Good. So John, just real brief, now that the farm bill is over, where is the corn growers going to be focusing their attention? What's on your plate now? What are your priorities?
Our three priorities now we have the farm bill done are protect the RFS, and then to protect the RFS, and then to protect the RFS. And then we have some methanol issues behind that. And I would say the fact that we had thousands of growers willingly participate in the comment process without having to go out and use some subterfuge and with a telephone system that, you know, I think you just had to see what our growers did. There's a lot of them out there. They wrote comments. They got their landlords to write comments. They got their kids to write comments. You know, I think that's important.
Why don't we just give everybody a chance just to talk quickly or briefly about what their priorities are moving forward as we, given the fact that we've got a somewhat dysfunctional Congress, we're in an election year. It's going to be somewhat challenging, but what for DuPont,
sure.
What are your priorities?
So let me first say, Bob, thanks for having me. Something you may not know, I'm a quiet person. I like to work alone in a small room, very few people policy. I don't like large crowds or cameras, so thank you for getting me out here. I wasn't expecting
this. We're all about giving people growth opportunities.
Thanks so much.
Pretty soon we're going to see Bob Greco grow when he embraces ethanol.
Two things for DuPont moving forward, and they both start with bio. One is biofuels and biotechnology. My days, every day, is dominated by the acceptance of biotechnology, corn, soybeans, et cetera. But also biofuels. Protecting the RFS is first and foremost for our company as well. We have lots of investments at stake. Congress spoke, we thought, clearly in 05 and 07, and we need to make sure that those policies stay in place.
Bob, we'll just work down the line. So API, you've got a lot on your plate, right? You've got the KL pipeline. You're probably trying to do everything you possibly can to hang on to those tax incentives. You've got climate change regulations you're probably not wild about. I mean, you've got a lot on your plate. So when you look at the whole scope of what your industry is facing, what are your top priorities?
Well, I'm a downstream guy, so I can have a narrow focus on just RFS, and rail, throw that in there, which we can talk about later. There's a lot of interest within API, clearly, on our continuing shale oil and gas revolution, which, despite what Bob was trying to allude to earlier, is the reason we're decreasing the use of imported oil. It's because of domestic oil and gas. It is the reason why our natural gas, our GHG emissions are at 20-year low. So there's a lot of interest in that, as well as moving towards exports. I think that's another area where I think our two industries share a mutual interest. We're trying to meet the president's goal of doubling exports. So I think you'll see a lot of interest on that as well. But obviously, RFS and Keystone Pipeline are very important to us as well.
Shane? What are the automakers thinking about these days?
Certainly there's a lot going on in the industry. Economically, it's a good time, right? We're selling more cars, which is a good thing. But we're very active on the legislative and regulatory front. I think you indicated legislatively could be a relatively quiet year, but I've been doing a lot of work with one of Aaron's counterparts on toxic substances reform. That actually may start to move this year, may not get over the goal line, but we'll see some movement. On the regulatory front, there's a lot going on with auto safety. We're kind of in the midst of a safety revolution, and there really is a lot going on there. So we have a few irons in the fire.
But I didn't hear you mention anything about the RFS in that.
Well, so as you know, we're kind of a, I'm not literally in the middle. I kind of thought you would put me right in the middle, but we sort of inhabit a middle ground, and I think you have several of my companies will be here tomorrow on a panel talking about some of our ideas to how to make things work going forward. I think we have concerns about the way that the RFS has been implemented up to now, but are interested in figuring out ways to make things work going forward.
But Chris?
On the RFS side, we've not staked out a specific position on any of the bills. Obviously, fuels remain a principal concern for us relative to the engine side of the equation. We're a regulated entity, and so those things relative to emissions and evaporative standards are big for us. We work closely with EPA and CARB on those. But we're a standard-setting organization. We develop safety standards, and so we do a lot of work in standards, statistics. We own a trade show. We have an education outfit that helps educate kids on the outdoors. And so while ethanol is a key issue for us, it's not the only issue for us.
Bob, you mentioned the RFS seeming to be a real high focus of yours anyway. Mm-hmm. Maybe it falls someplace else in terms of the overall API that has other issues, that they've got to look at. But it has been certainly a pretty significant focus of yours. We just ended a comment period on the RVOs, and we're all aware, because many of us got the calls, the robocalls that API was making to solicit support for your position on the RFS by suggesting that ethanol is going to increase the price of food and it's going to damage your engine, and if you agree, you want to stop that, please press 1. I got to hand it to you, heck of a strategy. I'm inclined to want to ask you how much you spent on those robocalls, but I know you won't answer.
Can we guess?
And so here's a question I do hope you'll answer. So how many calls did you make? Because I think half the people in this room got them, for crying out loud.
If only half, obviously we missed a few. So I'll work on that. We don't hide behind it. We've got a very large grassroots mobilization effort going on, not just on this issue. We've got energy citizens. We've got folks in every congressional district in this country who support the oil and gas industry, and we reach out to them on occasion. So we will continue to do that, and we've had a very good success rate mobilizing folks and educating them about these issues. You might differ with our talking points, but you may have to take that up on the fuel side, on the food side, with some of your folks in the poultry and the restaurant chain side, some of the engine folks. I mean, Shane and I can talk about the engine issues, so can Chris, but we're proud of that organization, and it's something that allows the American consumer to have a voice in public policy issues.
You know, I think you yourself have said API somehow isn't opposed to ethanol.
That's correct.
And yet your advertising and your messaging and your talking points sort of suggest otherwise.
Here's my question for you, because you're
in an incredibly difficult position. Because there are oil companies that absolutely support ethanol. We heard from one of them this morning that, you know, no, they may not like the policy, but they recognize that ethanol is going to be part of their future. And they recognize that ethanol is a good fuel component for not just the vehicle, but for the consumer. So how does it benefit your member companies to be denigrating the molecule in the way that your campaign is doing?
Well, first off, that's not true. We are very much in line with what you heard from Dave Weichert this morning. Ethanol has desirable blending properties. It would continue to be used with or without a mandate. It's economic to use. It provides octane. We are not anti-ethanol, and our members are not anti-ethanol. But what they are opposed to is unreasonable mandates, and there's broad support for that position. So you may hear otherwise, but that's not the intent of our messaging, and that's not what we're communicating. We support the use of ethanol. The problem is, and I think it works, frankly, to your advantage to conflate those two issues. When I hear people saying, even today, about the oil industry's anti-ethanol, no, they're not. The oil industry uses ethanol. It makes sense to use it. We continue to use it. So that's been our position, and that's where we are in the public policy debate right now.
Well, we'll agree to disagree, I guess, on the extent to which your messaging is denigrating the molecule. But I think when you tell little old ladies that happen to answer the phone when they're watching the Olympics that ethanol is going to be damaging their engines, they don't understand the distinction that you're making, and it's hurting everybody. But to a certain extent, Chris, you're in the same boat, right? Because you've got companies like John Deere that are extraordinarily supportive of ethanol, and yet some of your messaging also has been not all that constructive in terms of ethanol's impact on those small engines. So how do you balance the membership conflicts that would occur? And I'll tell you that the John Deere's E85 mower, that's kick butt.
You just mentioned the Flex product that John Deere has. You know, that's a Kawasaki product. Our engine makers are the names you know. It's Honda and Kawasaki and Yamaha and Briggs and Kohler and Subaru and others. These folks can design an engine to run on anything. We're not anti-ethanol either. The challenge for our industry is the machines we're making today are designed for specific fuel, and that's because of a relationship we have with EPA. We have something called a certification fuel. One of the reasons we've taken the positions we have, say, on E15, is the machines are not designed, built, or warranted to run on it. Our guys are consumer products companies. They want the safe, reliable use of their products in their customers' hands. That works just fine when they're run on a fuel for which they're designed. It doesn't work so well when they run it on a fuel for which they are not designed. And therein lies the challenge, is we're happy to design a future product to a future fuel that'll be in the marketplace that actually looks like the certification fuel we have. I represent more than 900 engine families before the United States Environmental Protection Agency. We're designing half of those families to E0. That's not because we choose it. We'd like it to be E10, frankly. That's the challenge we face, is we've got to work with the agency on the certification fuel that the federal government gives us to design an emissions profile that our products have to meet. So I know we're oftentimes challenged that we're anti-ethanol. Again, we're happy to build a fuel that runs on anything. I mean, an engine that runs on anything. Just let us know that fuel is going to be in the marketplace, that it matches the certification fuel, and we have a lead time for a transition.
How different are the weed whackers in Brazil from the weed whackers sold here?
Dramatically. They don't have adjustable parameters. They don't have a certification fuel. They don't have emissions regulation. Every one of your engine products, whether it's a generator, chainsaw, mower, et cetera, they're all regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency. The folks, the stuff we sell in Brazil.
But those are regulatory constraints. What's the practical difference between a weed whacker that's operating here and one in Brazil? I mean, it's the same companies.
You can and you can build them. It's adjustable. We're not allowed to put adjustable carbureted product into the marketplace in the United States.
John, the EPA in their RVO proposal sent a signal to the marketplace, rolling back the RFS. Your farmers, coming off of the single largest corn crop in history, and by the way, you're to be commended for that, with less inputs.
Thanks, some of our...
And DuPont. And DuPont. But what kind of a signal has been sent to farmers as a consequence of the RVO? What are they going to be doing this spring, given the uncertainty?
Well, I'll tell you what. One thing is they're mad as hell at Big Oil. Really mad. And I think that's part of it. Secondly is that this has been an economic engine in rural America that's taken the plywood off of the storefronts and Main Street in small communities. And folks are really nervous that that's going to go away. In fact, I wouldn't say they're nervous. I think they're afraid. And we have had some complacency in our industry in recent years. They're not complacent about this now. So as we saw corn go from $8 to $4, our guys are paying a lot of attention to this. And by the way, when it went from $8 to $4, how much did your groceries go down? Anybody want to? That much, right? So when you get a phone call and you're a farmer in middle America, and that ethanol plant has allowed your kids to come back to the farm, has allowed for you to have a viable community, has allowed for you to go ahead and keep your hospital, when you get a phone call that says high corn prices are, and ethanol are raising your food prices, they just get angry about it.
Well, feel free to take your anger out on the stage. I'm good with that. A little bit of excitement. Aaron, DuPont has been one of the leading companies. They've helped found the Fuels America campaign. I think some people in the room might be surprised by that. You want to explain to the audience why the Fuels America effort is so important to your company?
Sure. We have a lot of stake. On the obvious side, we produce seed corn that John's folks purchased to grow corn. Obviously, that finds its way into corn-based ethanol. We produce a lot of enzymes. We also have investments going into cellulosic ethanol, building a 30-million-gallon facility in Iowa. All of those things are at stake without the RFS. I mean, if the RFS is amended in a significant way, if the RFS goes away, or even what's happened with the RVO, that puts those investments at risk. When Congress passed the RFS in 05 and 07, we invested a lot of money, $500 million to date, to bring cellulosic ethanol online, also to improve corn yields, which we've done, drought survivability, et cetera. And those don't all go away if the RFS goes away. But certainly the portions dealing with biofuels and cellulosic ethanol and the next generation of fuels coming online that will equate to further investments in rural America and tax base are at stake. And that's why we're taking this very seriously and putting up not only capital but a lot of human capital on this issue as well.
Good. Bob, you personally, API generally has made a lot of the fact that the rising RIN prices are somehow impacting the price of gasoline. One of the things that I would hope that we may be able to agree upon is that the market for RINs might really benefit from a little bit of transparency. There ought to be, in our view, a better sense of just how many trades are being made and at what price and who's making them, not the specific companies, but at least the sectors, because I suspect that in a lot of these RIN transactions, there's been a fair amount of speculation, and it doesn't help you any more than it helps us. So just in the interest of comity, not comedy, Would you agree with me today that transparency on RIN markets is something we should be working toward?
Yes. We support transparent markets. We shouldn't lose sight, though, that what's going on in the RIN market, the volatility, is not caused by, would not be solved by more transparency. It's a reflection of the blend wall and how people are reacting to the future demand and the future availability of RINs. That's what's driving it. So, yeah, there's nothing wrong with increasing transparency. It's not going to get to the underlying problem regarding RINs. And we may have different views on whether high RIN prices are good or bad, but clearly the market's sending a signal about availability of RINs based on, and here we are over 50 cents again. We're starting that off again. The increase is occurring.
But just so that Rachel doesn't bury the lead, you do, in fact,
well, no,
transparency makes sense?
It's a distraction. It's not the lead. The lead is we need to resolve the blend wall once and for all. Transparency would be nice, yes. It's not something we're going to oppose. Certainly we support that. But it's not the underlying problem, and that's the availability of RINs and the blend wall.
I don't know if you can see it, but every time you say blend wall, there's a Pavlovian twitch. John.
Happy to help.
Well, you know, I mean, I hear from the oil industry about the blend wall, but, you know, every time I hear them say that, I kind of hear this cement mixer in the background. They got this great big stack of bricks, and they're just laying the wall as fast as they can. They've known since 2007 that they're going to be obligated parties. They're going to have to comply with the statute. And they're like the kid that kills his parents and throws himself at the mercy of the court because he's an orphan. They could have solved this problem.
John?
I want to give you a chance to respond, but I wanted the applause to get in there first.
Let's acknowledge a few changes in reality. For one thing, the back in 2007 when the RFS was passed, demand was projected to grow basically for the foreseeable future. What's happened since then is we've had a recession, we've had increased fuel economy, demand is dropping, and in fact is going to be plateauing at best. So we're talking about a plateauing gasoline demand with increasing ethanol demand, or ethanol mandate.
Bob,
you can't fit that much ethanol into the
mix. So what? In 2007, we weren't looking at a 350 billion gallon gasoline market at any time soon. Mm-hmm. We were always going to be beyond the 10% blend level.
At some point.
We're talking about whether that happens in 2013 or whether it was projected to happen in 2015. So what? The fact of the matter is, Shane's companies looked at the RFS, and they saw what the market signal was, and they invested in FFV technology. They produced FFVs. They did what they were supposed to do. People in this room did what they were supposed to do. And you guys went and got your brick and your mortar, and you erected a blend wall.
We supply fuels that can run in our customer's car. That's hopefully something you all took away from the earlier discussion today. It's a pull by the customer. The customer has to want that fuel. If a customer looks at his owner's manual, for the vast majority of the cars on the road, it says do not go above E10. So, yes, there are more cars coming on the road that are E15. There's still a few FFVs on the road. That's a whole other issue because with the CAFE requirement credit going away, I'm not sure how much of an FFV market there's going to be going forward. That's
great,
a legitimate question.
Great segue, actually, the question I have for Shane.
Right. You can ask me about future
because
product
I think this
plans.
Argument, I think Bob's argument is dying here.
Yeah.
Shane. 80% of the top 20 selling vehicles in the United States today recognize and warranty E15 blends. So,
yep.
Given that situation, is the Auto Alliance's opposition to E15 weakening at all? Are you feeling the earth move under you?
Okay,
and not just because I'm rocking the stage?
So, as you know, Bob, our opposition to E15 has always been premised on the fact that the E15 was approved for vehicles that weren't built, certified, warranted to run on E15. And in fact, I think, you know, it is a good news story, and it's similar to what Chris said. You know, our guys can build vehicles to run on any blend of fuel. And the fact is, EPA having approved E15 and looking at the RFS in the future, you know, a lot of our guys have already started building, certifying, and warrantying vehicles to run on E15. And I expect that to continue.
Awesome. Maybe do a sort of a wrap-up question on this topic, because we do need to move to some other topics. But maybe from Chris on down, what is your expectation for legislation on the RFS in this coming year?
Oh, I think it's not likely at all. What movement I think you had, what energy there was for reform, and there was, I think, some movement. I think the EPA revisions of the 2014 targets took the wind out of that. By the time they final, you're going to be in a primary cycle. You're in an election year, so this year I think is essentially dead. So the Deer Flex product is a Kohler product, not a Kawasaki product. I'll hear about that in the car on the way to the airport. Needed to correct myself.
Shane.
I, as a practical matter, I think I generally agree with Chris, though. You know, part of the wind going out of the sails was EPA's proposal. So if they do a 180 when they finalize, that's certainly going to gin things back up. But, you know, can anything get over the goal line this year? I doubt it.
Bob?
Yeah, we have a narrow window for action. I think this is a Congress that is hyper-partisan. However, the RFS is not a partisan issue. It's a geographic issue more than partisan. So I think it's a narrow window. We are going to continue to push for that. We'll continue to push next year if need be. This is a long-term issue that needs to be fixed, and we're going to keep pushing. We're up about 200 members of Congress, I think, have now gone on the record saying the RFS needs to be lowered in some way, shape, or form. You're getting close to that 218 where you'd have critical mass to move something in the House. So it's continuing to grow, and we're going to keep pushing.
A lot of that opposition has been fomented with a fair amount of what I would characterize, misinformation. The CRC study that you often point to as justification for your comments about engine damage has been thoroughly refuted by Oak Ridge National Laboratories and several others. There are now 41 studies out there that came to a much different conclusion than that one CRC study. So just quickly, let's try not to get into the weeds. I'll have to bring up Jeff Cooper. But why is EPA, DOE, Oak Ridge National Laboratory, all these other people that have studied this wrong, and CRC's one 8-car study right?
First off, the CRC E15 is not a one 8-car study. We did multiple studies, probably 20-ish. You don't hear about the other ones because E15 worked in many other situations. So it's not...
E15 worked?
Sure. On some vehicles and some components, we tested the range of components that a customer might have some reaction to. EPA focused on emissions. That's why the same Oak Ridge National Lab also found a problem with check engine lights on cars. Go figure. They went off because of E15. So we're looking at the whole customer experience, the auto industry and the oil industry. We stand behind that research. It was well designed. And at the end of the day, we say we supply the fuel that the car manufacturers designed and warranted to, not what EPA provided. We have to face that reality.
Isn't it true, though, that in that CRC study, the vehicle running on year zero also failed?
One failed.
So you admit it.
No, one failed, but it was later determined by the vehicle manufacturer that test cycle wasn't appropriate for the vehicle. It was transparent in there, but when they broke down the engine, they saw even increased valve pitting and valve damage on E20 and E15. So that's all in the same study. So, yeah, we don't hide behind our studies.
I give you credit because when the representative from the CRC was testifying before the United States Congress, he completely ignored the fact that a vehicle running on E0 failed at all, pretending it didn't exist.
We're just not ignoring the other
vehicles. So you at least have come forward today. I appreciate that. Yeah. Aaron, legislation?
I agree with the other panelists. I don't see a way that any significant reforms find their way to the president's desk. At some point in time, maybe an amendment comes up somewhere. But, you know, it's no real concern about having something happen this year, significant reform in the RFS that the president would sign.
John?
Let me say, I like Bob Greco.
I do too.
I have friends at API. But if any person in this room doesn't think that they won't leap at the chance to get rid of the RFS between now and the election or during the lame duck session, you're crazy. Don't be complacent. These folks are spending millions and millions and millions of dollars to take away the RFS, the thing that has built your industry. So if you think that, well, gosh, you know, it's a dysfunctional Congress, yeah, it is a dysfunctional Congress. Welcome to some of the dysfunctionality, but I think everybody in this room ought to embrace a little paranoia on this one.
Hear, hear. Chris, Your organization has embarked on a rather aggressive campaign, Look Before You Pump, making sure that people understand the fuel that's in there and make sure it's appropriate for their engine. We actually support that. We're with you. We read with some interest your testimony to the state of South Dakota a couple of years ago, talking about your concerns for suboctane gasoline and how it would cause engine damage. But I find it somewhat curious that your Look Before You Pump campaign is focused on E15 that's today is sold in 60 stations across the country, and you're not telling people to look before they pump on suboctane gasoline. Can you explain to me why that is?
It's good job, Christy. She was already on me this morning. Our experience is with ethanol fuels, not necessarily suboctane.
But that's the risk. Your letter to South Dakota said it could be catastrophic engine damage. So you get some experience with it. If you're concerned about suboctane gasoline, then my goodness, seems to me a look before you pump campaign might be a good idea.
The challenge is communicating with the customer. There's limited, you know, communications 101, keep it simple, keep it tight, say it over and over and over. The challenge our folks are facing in the marketplace, and this is look before you pump, and you're going to see an announcement very soon involving major retail. Part of the reason we've done it is because of desire by major retailers to begin to educate people. Part of it is the change in the flex fuel marketplace. It's not just E15. As more fuels come onto the marketplace, mid-levels and others, that folks find themselves exposed to, the chance of misfueling increases. Now, Bob, we believe strongly, as you well know, that the E15 warning label is wholly inadequate to educate, you know, 150 million people about the way they purchase fuel. It's why we're suing this guy.
Why is it wholly inadequate? I think it makes it pretty clear. It says it's unlawful. Language that EPA adopted from your comments, by the way. It's unlawful to blend. So if the EPA label is somehow not adequate, what is adequate? What kind of a label would you say is enough for a consumer to recognize that E15 shouldn't be put in their chainsaw?
I'd be happy to have that conversation with you. I think it's more than what EPA has proposed. One of the challenges is maybe a similar message is not on flex. The challenge is historically, people buy, and you heard it this morning, people buy their fuel largely on price, right? And whatever goes in the car or the pickup truck goes in the can. Whatever goes in the can goes in the bass boat and the snowmobile and the generator and the chainsaw and the mower. Well, that's a paradigm shift to basically say there's one fuel for the car or pickup, if it's a flex product or a newer product, and then suddenly not. And so, again, we probably have 300 million pieces in the field, 150 million people using them. So if you want to bring ethanol, I'm an old guy. I remember gasohol. And I'm from southern Indiana. I'm from corn country, Jackson County. I'd much rather see farmers make fuel for this country than an Arab sheikh, trust me. But what you don't want to see is failed product or somebody hurt. That will hurt ethanol. And so we think we should work with you folks and others to talk to people about the changing fuel marketplace.
I would love to work with you on a label that you think would be acceptable. I've asked you before, you know, what is it? But let's do that. But, you know, when I'm out there on a Saturday morning and I'm trying to, you know, refuel my chainsaw, the most challenging thing for me, I'm just a kid from Boston, is what's the oil-gasoline ratio? You know, do I have enough in there? That's the challenge. So what I'd really like for you to focus on an education campaign so that we get the oil-gasoline ratio right. But, you know, we all have different priorities. Shane, talked a little bit about 84, 85 octane fuels. Is the Auto Alliance real comfortable having suboctane gasoline out there?
Now, see, I knew you were going to ask me about suboctane. You're going to get in the weeds with me so fast. So you do know that someone from our state affairs team was testifying alongside Chris in South Dakota. I mean, we absolutely oppose suboctane fuels. We went to the South Dakota legislature. We will continue to oppose suboctane fuels if they're, you know, wherever they're proposed.
With us, it's just sort of it's a relative balance, right?
Yeah.
There's suboctane gasoline that's being sold throughout PADD 4 at a lot more stations, impacting a lot more consumers than E15. And we're just sort of confused as to why all the focus has to be on, oh, my goodness, there's all this E15 out there, when you folks are ignoring the very real problems that could be caused by suboctane gasoline.
So, we're not ignoring them, obviously. Again, an effort by the South Dakota legislature was strongly opposed by our industries. But you are talking about, you know, one state versus a federal, not requirement, but a federal approval, I guess. So the fact that suboctane gas may exist is also different from the government, advancing a policy that would allow suboctane gasoline.
And Bob, the engine effect is different. Suboctane has, we agree, we're on the same position with Shane on suboctane. But one of the challenges relative to ethanol, and especially relative to our industry and the marine industry, limited use, recreational use, seasonal use, emergency use, is ethanol in the fuel that sits for a while can become challenging. And again, this look before you pump, for us, is the next stage of communications is the use of additives, stabilizers, et cetera. One of the challenges with ethanol is it's hydroscopic. And so in a marine environment and some of the stuff that sits for a while. So again, suboctane is an issue, but it's not the issue for us that ethanol is.
But you shouldn't be leaving gasoline sit for a while either. I mean, there are maintenance issues for all fuels. All right, I want to try to move to something that can be a little bit more constructive. I do try to find areas of agreement where I can. Bob, you had indicated early on that among your priorities after RFS was rail.
Spent a lot of time on that the past couple weeks, yes.
So, I mean, rail is a huge issue for you guys. You want to talk about that just a little bit, and maybe we can find an area of agreement?
Sure. I'll stay out of the weeds on this. We have a situation where because of the Bakken, the tight oil development, we're now moving increasing amounts of crude oil by rail, also because we can't get pipelines approved. So as a result, we're starting to experience, unfortunately, more accidents with that. And we've had similar derailments on the ethanol side. It's been a shipping issue in general with oil industry, the ethanol industry, chemical industry, et cetera. And there's a real concern out there that DOT and political expediency is trying to strengthen existing tank cars without focusing on the root cause of the accidents, which, to quote Bob Dineen, is to keep the cars on the track. Derailments are seven times more likely to cause an accident than any other cause. So the shippers in general are very united on this, saying, let's focus on root causes. Let's fix derailments. Let's keep these cars on the tracks. Our industries jointly have petitioned DOT for the past 3 or 4 years to build it, to approve a better car. Our industries jointly have been building those better cars without the government's support. And now we're being forced into possibly having to retrofit or phase out cars that have been designed because of the government's inaction and need to sort of move quickly to show they're doing something. So it's a real big challenge because both of our industries have invested billions of dollars in brand new tank cars to move increased amounts of ethanol and move increased amount of crude oil. So we stand behind our safety, and it's truly an emerging issue for our industries, and one that I think that we're on the same page on.
Does API or will API ever support retrofits for tank cars you've bought in the last 5 years that at the time were certified for 30, 40, 50 years life?
We want to be driven by the data. We haven't seen any data that says that retrofits will improve the safety, because what you end up doing is changing the risk equation. If you add more weight to put more shielding on a car, you have to carry less fuel or less ethanol. That means you put more cars on the track. You've shifted risk in that regard. If you add extra cladding, they're too wide to go by each other. So that's added risk. So you've got to approach this holistically. Right. And ultimately, we have safe cars. We want to keep those safe cars on the road.
And again, just so that Rachel doesn't bury the lead, you were quoting me.
I was quoting you.
That's awesome. Shane, tier three, Where is that going? What's your expectation, and how important is reducing sulfur content to automakers?
Much more important than it is to API. Let's compare notes, okay. Bob. I mean, we are expecting the EPA to issue a final rule on Tier 3 by the end of the first quarter here. It could lag a little bit, but I wouldn't expect it to lag much. We are expecting lower sulfur content to be a part of that final rule. It's certainly critical to us for making emissions systems work at the very, very stringent levels that will be proposed or will be included in a final rule in Tier 3. So. We've been supportive of the Tier 3 rule. California already has rules that we're having to design vehicles to, so this will harmonize and match up.
Shane, my experience has been...
And thank you for diverting at least a little bit of Bob's attention and money away from low sulfur gasoline.
Yeah, no problem. And actually, on that point, I was going to just give you some counsel, because my experience with API is that when they don't like something, they litigate. And they got more money than God and more lawyers than anybody. And Bob, are you already preparing litigation against the Tier 3 rule?
We'll see when it comes out. Our concern is Tier 3 is whether the benefits are worth the cost, and we think EPA still feels that it is. But we've been trying to educate the administration about lead-in times. Right now, we're looking at it maybe a 3-year lead-in time. They're going to give the autos a phase-in on the vehicles, but not the fuel manufacturers. And 3 years is just insufficient to go forward with this big a sulfur reduction. The required investments can't be achieved that quickly. You're really risking supply impacts with an arbitrarily short implementation time. So we're trying to educate the administration about, if you're going to go forward with this, make sure you provide flexibilities and implementation lead time to allow our industry to adjust to it.
I can't believe you're not expressing more confidence in your industry, because
you still may sue.
I think given a proper market signal, you'd be surprised at how quickly manufacturers can respond. I've got an example I can give to you.
The issue is have refiners. I don't know about ethanol plant turnaround. Refiners turn around about every 5 years to do the maintenance. If you've got a 3-year lead time, you're now forcing companies to modify their facilities off the schedule, line up the work. It's difficult, because there aren't that many fabricators and designers around. So it truly is an implementation issue.
Chris, does low sulfur gasoline impact small engines?
Not so much, but I think there's a bigger picture here, and it's a problem for anybody in the oil or the ethanol business, is our regulators, a lot of the regulators look unfavorably on internal combustion engines. My industry is bringing a lot of electric, corded, propane, compressed natural gas, solar, a bunch of different fuel sources into the marketplace. Our friends at the California Air Resources Board want to see electric and hybrid products in their state, and I think there's a lot of effort here to demonize, challenge, and force out of the marketplace internal combustion engines.
Aaron, we're about to go into a session on advanced ethanol and cellulosic ethanol. Your company is obviously very involved in that. Prior to that discussion that will occur in a few moments, you want to give your thoughts on what is the single most important thing that the government can do to encourage the commercialization of cellulosic ethanol?
Yeah, let me first start by saying DuPont's been in existence since 1802. I woke up in Cleveland, Ohio yesterday. Ohio came in existence in 1803. We're older than Ohio. I mean, the company just doesn't jump at fads.
That's maybe not something you want to brag about.
I don't know if that's going to be the new catchphrase. I think we'll stick with miracles from science. But cellulosic ethanol is a reality. We've perfected this at a demonstration scale. We're bringing online cellulosic at the commercial scale. What we need is policy certainty, and that's for any industry. I mean, that's what we need for cellulosic today. I assume Bob would say that's what they need for continued oil
production.
Let's
give a chance. Is policy certainty important?
Certainly.
Okay, good.
And that's what it is. I mean, that's the single most important thing is maintaining policy certainty.
Yeah. We got to wrap up, but with such an august group of political prognosticators, I'm not going to ask you about the Olympics. That's been done already. But I will ask you, in your wheelhouse, Do you expect in the elections coming up this fall the United States Senate to flip? And if the Senate does flip, what do you expect the impact to be on fuels policy, John?
I think that we could see a Senate that's 50-50. I'm going to flip, and I'm going to have the quarter stand on its edge. No one controls the Senate unless you have to have at least 60 votes. Unless Ted Cruz is on your side, then you need about 63. But no, I think it'll be 50-50. And will it make a difference? It will if we keep our eye off the prize. We need to be involved. We need people who serve us in Congress to know how important this is, and we need to start holding them accountable.
Aaron?
Yeah, I think to John's point, I don't know if it matters if it flips. It matters from who has the bully pulpit. I don't know if it matters from a legislation passing the finish line and going to the White House for signature. That doesn't minimize, again, to John's point, sorry, I keep agreeing with you, John, the importance of engagement. This is, you know, risky times. There's a lot of investment being made. There is a potential shift in policy afoot. So introducing that sense of paranoia, I think, is important to keep people engaged or more engaged. I think to the point before, people had gotten a bit disengaged in the past as everything was cheery and moving forward, and we're at an important point.
Bob?
Yeah, like I said before, I don't view the RFS as a partisan issue. It is geographic in my mind. So I'm not sure if it makes a difference. I'll agree with John. I don't think it necessarily makes a difference. It depends on who's in Congress and the ultimate makeup. So beyond, and whether it'll flip, I think it's going to be close, but I think it's quite a slog to expect it to slip. And they got to run the table, the Republicans, to accomplish that.
Shane?
A month ago I thought that the folks who were saying that the Senate had a good chance of flipping were kind of crazy. The poll numbers I've seen over the last month in particular were, some races like Michigan may actually be in play. Those are kind of interesting poll numbers, still a long way out. Better than even odds that the Senate flips, but ultimately just barely if it does flip. And like Bob, my experience working on these issues, they're not partisan, they're regional. And so, as a Democrat or a Republican from Indiana, necessarily going to have a different view of ethanol? Not necessarily.
Pubs pick up a couple. I don't know that they get it. If they do, though, I think the pubs should be cautious that if they have both houses, I think modestly improve the prospects for the 2016 Democrat presidential candidate.
Do you have any predictions on what her name will be?
I think it might be Hillary.
All right. Please join me in thanking this distinguished panel. It was a lot of fun. We are back now in...